There's a tectonic shift in America's healthcare industry. Where does that leave America's family physicians? To answer that, I want to welcome Dr. Wanda Feiler, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you very much.
So are you making a Wisconsin house call?
I am making a Wisconsin.
You practice in Pennsylvania?
Well, I practice in Pennsylvania, but I've spent a lot of years off and on through Wisconsin because my mother's from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So we'd fly into Wausau and drive up, and so I've enjoyed Wisconsin for quite some time.
So there are 124,900 physicians and medical students in your organization.
Yes.
Talk to me about the role of family physicians now in this, well, I said tectonic shift. Is that an unfair analogy?
No, that's perfect.
Okay.
And we love this tectonic shift. The American healthcare system has been upside down for too long. We've had a healthcare system that is incredibly expensive, mm-hmm. bankrupting the country, mm-hmm. and not getting the quality we need. It's been very fragmented with lots of specialists. We've got, if you're one of those people who wants just that specialty care, you're going to get really good care. But most of us take care of the whole person.
Yes.
And the healthcare systems in the world that do a better job, and they do a better job with better outcomes at dramatically lower price points, do so on a very strong primary care backbone. And when I say primary care, I'm not only talking about head colds and sore throats, but helping you manage your chronic disease, knowing who you are as a patient in the context of your family and your community, and helping you meet your personal health goals. And that's what family physicians do. And right now, my members do 1 out of 5 U.S. office visits.
1 out of 5.
1 out of 5. We are also the number one job opportunity in healthcare 10 years running. And the demand for family physicians is climbing dramatically. And in this new tectonic shifted healthcare system, we believe that it's going to put primary care back at the strong backbone of a healthcare system. And then that frees up dollars that we don't have to be spending on healthcare, get better outcomes, better quality, better, healthier communities, and let those dollars go to other things, education, housing, food, and all the infrastructure needs we have in this country.
What's the demographic profile of the average family physician in America? Male, female, how old, how soon going to retire? Do you face a shortage?
We face retirement issues, but right now we also have 28% of all U.S. medical students are members of our academy. Now, we don't have yet 28% of them matching into family medicine, mm-hmm. but their interest is there, and we are seeing the numbers are very much moving upward. More students are interested. We have a rapid growth in our young physician population, but we also have a second blip, if you will, in the 55-plus group. So one of the things about family physicians, though, is they don't typically retire at 60, 62. They tend to, it's not unusual for them to go into their 70s, 75, even 80. There is a concern right now about some what we call burnout among especially that experienced group of physicians because of a lot of the chaos in healthcare, and we're doing a lot as we can to support that. About 50% of our demographic, I think 47% are female. And so and we've also, as family physicians, we tend to be a very diverse crowd in terms of our ethnic and cultural backgrounds.
Beware of a potentially stupid question. Can I use GP, general practitioner, and family practice interchangeably? Correct me.
Great question. No, not generally. And
okay,
if you can be a GP by going out and doing a 1-year typically rotating internship and you're done. To be a family physician, you have to do a residency. That's usually 3 years, sometimes 4 years. That 3 to 4 year training, if you think about it, if you're going to be a pediatrician, you do a 3-year residency in pediatrics, internal medicine, 3 years residency, in family medicine, 3 years of residency.
How does Wisconsin rank in terms of the number of family physicians? Do we have enough? Do we have a scarcity?
Everybody's got a scarcity.
Is that part of the reason for your house call in Wisconsin?
Exactly. Yesterday I spoke to the mostly first year medical students at University of Wisconsin and talked to them about family medicine as a career and the amazing opportunities that has. Wisconsin at the moment has 167 openings for family physicians, and the new workforce study that I saw that came out in the last week or two, the three big areas of physician need for Wisconsin, which mirrors the rest of the country, is family medicine, general psychiatry, and general surgery.
167 openings.
Yes, and projected to be between 800 and 3,000 more needed.
Well, so yesterday you were a cheerleader, wrong term, you were a recruiter for family practice. What did you tell these first-year medical students when they, maybe I read too much, but specialists make more,
right?
And when you come out of there with high debt, they're tempted to go into specialty. So what cheerleading outfit did you, or speech did you give yesterday?
You don't want to see me in a cheerleading outfit, I guarantee it. What I say to them is, when you choose family medicine, you choose more. I have the opportunity. We have data that shows, first of all, that we do 1 out of 5 office visits. Our visits are far more complex than our specialty colleagues mm-hmm. because the patients that I see typically have 5 to 7 different diagnoses. But more than that, I know you as a person, and my care for you is relationship-based. And so it's not the one-off visit, and I only take care of one organ system or one age group or one gender. I get to take care of you across your lifespan. I might deliver your baby. I may be there at the end of your life. I'm going to be there through the hills and valleys of your life and get to know you, know your personal health goals, and you and I would be a team. And what we know is that, again, that if you put a family physician into a community, family physicians are the only group where you can put a physician into a community and actually see the death rates drop. If I do that with our specialty colleagues, and my husband's the super subspecialist, and so I love them dearly, but the death rates do not drop and the costs go up substantially. Family physicians, the cost stays the same or drops for spending, and the health of the community as well as the health of the individual rises. So what I find that this generation, this group of millennials, have a very strong community service focus, and they very much want to do the right thing. And so family medicine resonates for them. They also want to be activists. They want to be advocates for patients. They want to be meaningful change for the better in their communities, and that's exactly who we are. So it's not a difficult sell. When we talk about the debt and the salaries, Wisconsin's done a great job with, you know, starting to figure out ways to help mitigate some of that debt and encourage people to go into family medicine and get them out into rural Wisconsin. Not all states have done as well as Wisconsin. There's always room to do more, especially with 167 openings.
Yes.
But we also are seeing salaries increase pretty significantly for family physicians around the country, 17% up last year alone.
I want to come back to the 167 openings. Are most of them in northern Wisconsin, which is more rural areas?
I know a lot of them are.
Is there a huge disparity?
I know there's a lot of them in northern Wisconsin. I can't tell you if it's most, because we know that in a countrywide, it's not only it's rural America very much so, but also urban inner city populations. And then you also want to look at the demographics of that workforce and make sure that it is similar to the needs of that population, because patients frequently want someone to take care of them who looks like them. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to make sure that the diversity of your family physician workforce and your healthcare workforce writ large mimics a lot of what your population is.
But what about those national stats? The average pay of a specialist is what versus a family physician is what?
Family physician right now is about $225, according to the one survey that I saw, and that's up 17% in a year. And what we tell medical students is that's still a very, very good wage compared to what your patients earn. And most students, as soon as they hear $225,000 a year, are absolutely satisfied with that, even when they've got $200,000, $300,000 in student debt. But loan
forgiveness. What's the average student debt of a medical student?
It depends. What I'm typically hearing is. That's okay. One is 100 to 200,000. The worst I've heard was over New Jersey at 400,000. But that's a mortgage, and that's a mortgage on their future.
Yes.
So loan forgiveness for students is really important. Loan forgiveness for someone, for instance, who graduates from a Wisconsin residency program and then says, I'm going to stay in Wisconsin. I know Wisconsin's got a program in place right now. They'll give them $20,000 per year for 3 years if they stay in that community. And we know that when they stay in that community for 3 years, they're often likely to stay in that community for 30 years.
How does Wisconsin's incentive program compare to others across the nation? Are we high? Are we low? About average?
I actually think you're pretty good.
Okay.
Probably a little higher, but there's always more work to be done. You're showing leadership. There's more opportunity to do that, to expand, particularly the loan forgiveness, the rural efforts to recruit people into rural workforce. Yesterday at the University of Wisconsin, I heard about their WARM program, where they actually have students that are going out and working in rural parts and working in practices. And those students develop relationships. They see that they can have a great life in rural America and have a wonderful practice and be the kind of physician that they went to medical school to be.
Okay, you wave a flag. If you go into family medicine, you can earn $225. You didn't tell me what specialists earn.
Oh, it depends. It could be, we are ranked about third or fourth from the bottom. So pediatrics, psychiatry, right now endocrinology are below that. If you're doing orthopedics, you might be up at 600,000. But what I find with medical students, it's not necessarily about their income. Mm-hmm. I think we tend, you know, those of us who are a little more senior tend to think that way. But the medical students want to know that they can have a life, that they can have a meaningful impact on their communities, that they can have time with their families. And one of the bigger concerns I hear is what is that work-life balance? Right. And for family physicians right now, that is a huge concern because there's a lot of burnout across medicine, and family medicine is one of the more heavily impacted.
Well, talk to me about the trend that I read about and help me understand it, where if a family physician has his or her own practice, they're increasingly being bought by the large healthcare networks, aren't they?
Yeah. In my understanding is that in Wisconsin, 87% of physicians in practice are part of a large system, and that is dramatically above what I see in other parts of the country.
Is that a bad or a good thing, doctor?
That's a matter of opinion.
And yours is?
Mine is either way. I think if it's working for the physician, it's working for the patient, it's working for the community, and everyone is satisfied, as long as the health systems recognize that when those of us that are working hard to lift the salaries of family physicians, and that helps part of the recruitment to get more students into family medicine, to bring back that joy of practice, that those health systems understand that when they need to pass on those dollars to those practicing physicians, mm-hmm. and not absorb it in their overhead and their middle management and their costs, but actually put it to the people who are creating value for the systems, that's where you really start to see a workforce change. And I have some physicians who love being an independent practice around the country, and they're doing all sorts of new innovative models. We know, though, that regardless of who owns the practice, that small practice, that one or two doc practice, oftentimes their quality numbers are better than the big groups. And oftentimes it's because they have that really tight one-to-one relationship. But those practices are struggling right now. It's become very expensive. Electronic health records are not helping matters. They're very clunky. And they're taking hours and hours away from family time in the evening. And that's across medicine, not just family medicine.
Well, 87% of Wisconsin family physicians are part of larger networks.
I understand it, it's groups 50-plus.
50-plus.
Right.
And that's much higher than the...
Significantly higher. Probably at least 20-25% percentage points higher than the rest of the country.
Well, if you're part of a larger network, then one of the ways you're tracked is how long you spend with a patient. What's on average the average time that a family physician spends with a patient?
Well, one of the ways you're actually tracked and compensated is right now, unfortunately, in many healthcare systems in this country, is you're tracked on volume. It's not some. It's more.
How many patients you see?
Yeah.
How many tests you mandate? What?
No, it's more what we call RVUs. It's a very antiquated system. It's part of that tectonic shift that's coming.
Yeah.
In paying right now in this country, we've paid for healthcare that's volume driven.
Yes.
So I like, and I told the students this yesterday. I think about Lucy in the chocolate factory. You know, and she's throwing pieces of candy into the hat, and it's crazy. That's not how you should have a healthcare system. And what we're doing in this country is shifting over to what we call a value-based system. And the goal is to get family docs off that hamster wheel, see more and more and more, because what I'm hearing from physicians around this country, family physicians, they want more face-to-face time with patients. They want to be able to spend more than 7 to 10 minutes, 15 minutes with a patient. With 5 to 7 diagnoses, your patients typically need sometimes 30, 45 minutes. And right now, I've got maybe 15, 20 minutes with you max, and then I've got to turn around and spend another equal amount of time on the computer, as well as prior authorizations, because they don't want me to do labs, they don't want me to order meds, there's all this ridiculous administrivia, we refer to it, that is really taking me away from you. Taking me away from face-to-face time with patients. And so we need to figure out how to be more efficient in the healthcare system. Those prior authorizations that are eating away time, destroying morale, taking me away, and you wonder why you can't get an appointment fast enough. And you wonder why I don't spend time with you, or you wait in the waiting room. These are the reasons.
How long until this nation gets on top of the electronic medical records?
From your mouth to God's ears. We have been pushing hard. We have been pushing.
Has there been major progress made?
There's been incremental progress made. We as an organization, and you know, my members do 1 out of 5 office visits. So we have a very frequent conversation with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, and very specifically the Office of the National Coordinator in D.C., talking about electronic health records. And we are ready. We're ready not even for 2.0, but 3.0. Why other industries can do this? Healthcare is the only industry when you add technology, you've had to hire more people. And it's really slowed people down. It's creating substantial burnout. And it's most of them were built on billing platforms, not patients. And my job is to take care of patients. But we've had to hire 1, 2, 3 full-time equivalent people just to manage some of the chaos that's been created by all of this.
5 years into the Affordable Care Act, impact on family physicians in America, doctor?
The demand for primary care has gone up dramatically. The demand, and actually the volume of office visits has gone up dramatically. But it's interesting when you look at the three drivers of that. The number one driver for the huge uptick in demand is actually population growth. The second uptick, and I'm talking, these first two are about 92%. The second big driver has been the aging of our population. Mm-hmm. And people, we know that people who have a usual source of care and they have health insurance are the people that are most likely to be healthier. And in this country, usual source of care is typically a family physician. The smallest driver in the single digits has actually been the Affordable Care Act. So, but what we're finding, we've had a policy as an organization way pre-ACA for a very long time that we need health care coverage for all, because that's clearly was a barrier. And as recently as about 2 weeks ago, we released a study that we did on men's health. And men's health, 7 years ago when we did it, that was a huge barrier, was lack of insurance. It's almost disappeared in this year's study. And that's good news.
The nation is healthier because of the ACA, because more people have health care coverage? True or false?
I think it's too early to know.
Okay.
It's too early to know. You know, health is not something that turns on a dime. And so what we do now is we've got an investment in people, and we've got I know there's an awful lot of tweaking that needs to be done, and there's an opportunity to fix some things, because it's still way too costly. There's still a lot of unnecessary, duplicative, and potentially harmful care, and that's why you need to refocus back to a primary care-driven system. Some place where we focus on wellness, prevention, making sure if you have a chronic disease, we get you under good control, and that I'm a teammate with you, that I also know that you're being, you know, that you've got a bad housing situation, or there's violence in your home, or you're being bullied at work, or there's substance abuse. Lots of things beyond what we do. It's not just about your blood pressure, your cholesterol, your blood sugar. There's a whole other part of your life that directly impacts your health care, and that's why you need somebody who knows you.
But it seems to me that the ACA is at a crossroads. There, 5 states next year will only have one insurer under the exchanges. Major health networks are dropping out of the ACA, and you're seeing some huge premiums.
So, you are.
Where do we go next with the ACA, or do we take a next major step towards universal care, single payer?
You know, it's funny. We, as an organization, we haven't taken a stance on single payer at all. But I do have an opportunity to interface with my Canadian colleagues at least twice a year. And as we keep telling them that everyone talks to us about single payer, and they start laughing and say, "Oh, please run,
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 run, run from it,
run from it." And they keep saying, we keep being hearing, we need to do what the Americans are doing, and we will say to them, run and run from it. So I don't think we found a perfect solution. What I know is that there are basic health care needs. The countries that do it better, as I mentioned earlier, do it on a strong backbone of primary care, where you can better control costs, catch things early, prevent a lot of disease. And also, we've been working with a program across many societies called Choosing Wisely. Many medical associations are doing Choosing Wisely. And this is the things that say, here's the things we should not be doing. We should not, for instance, be giving antibiotics to someone with a mild to moderate sinus infection. Mm-hmm. We should not be doing an x-ray, a regular plain x-ray of the low back, for someone who's had back pain for less than 4 weeks. Particularly if they don't have any red flags worrying about other things. That's wasteful care, because those people get better on their own. And so maybe sometimes we should sit on our hands instead of typing into that electronic health record.
Let's talk about the two largest generations in America, millennials and baby boomers.
Right.
How do their expectations and needs of healthcare differ? Millennials younger, they're healthier. Boomers older. But do they have different expectations in terms of healthcare delivery?
You know, I think there was a sense at the beginning that millennials would be very technology driven. But what we're finding is millennials still value relationships. And millennials still want a trusted advisor. They want someone, whether it's a trusted advisor for their health, a family physician, whether it's for a banker. They like technology. They like some ease of use. So, you know, some of the telemedicine that many of our practices are incorporating, that works for them. Being able to go online and send an email or through our web portal a question to your doctor, which most of our members do, mm-hmm. being able to ask that question, they're more comfortable with that. But they still want that person who knows them. And that's not unlike their baby boomer. Now, the baby boomers have other challenges simply by aging into more disease states.
And there is a tremendous shortage nationally in geriatric specialists, aren't there?
There are for those that are designated. Right now, most geriatric care in this country is done by family physicians. And quite frankly, it's an integral part of our training.
Yes.
Because we take that on. You know, we actually get trained across the lifespan. But we do, and a lot of geriatricians are family physicians or they're general internists, primary care internists. And so most family medicine does a lot of geriatrics. I spent 14 years in a practice where if the patient was under 70, it was unusual. And I love that because they're great people. We have a wonderful relationship. I had the chance to speak at one patient's funeral. I did quite a few home visits. I love that. It's very rewarding, and they're a very gracious group of people typically to take care of. Really, really good relationship. It brings back very much the human factor in healthcare.
It seems to me we're 10 weeks out from a presidential election. I'm not going to ask you who you favor, but here's what I am going to ask. Has Mr. Trump or Ms. Clinton presented the most complete campaign platform or specifics in terms of the future of healthcare in America? Who has offered the most specific plan?
I don't know that we've seen much from either camp yet.
Really?
The way we'd want. We're starting to see more out of the Clinton camp around healthcare. We're still kind of drilling through that as an organization. We're going to work with either party, regardless of how this outcome comes, you know, this election comes out. There's a lot of work to be done in healthcare. I do think we're seeing some very, very primary care appropriate proposals coming out of the Clinton campaign. I haven't heard that quite yet from the Trump campaign, but you know they may have a different timeline for releasing.
You encourage or discourage by the increasing specifics coming from the Clinton campaign?
I'm encouraged.
You're encouraged.
It's always better. I think it's always better to have a sense of what they're thinking. You know, I would be encouraged even when a patient has more specifics. They tell me really what they're thinking. It's always easier to know the ground you stand on.
What role or what blame do America's physicians get for the heroin and opiate epidemic?
There's a lot of blame to go around on this one. And I will tell you that back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a national campaign, and it's called Pain is the Fifth Vital Sign. And America's physicians were told, you're not doing a good job on managing pain. We need you to be more liberal with opioids. And that came from the federal government, it came from the Veterans Administration, it came from multiple sources, some private associations, some industry people. And I think physicians overall felt indicted. And we were told people are suffering, people are in pain, and you need to start prescribing more. Not only
that. The shorthand was prescribe more opioids?
Prescribe, yeah. Be more aggressive and more liberal with your pain medication.
Okay. And this this message emerged in when? Did you say
1990s? Late 1990s, early 2000s.
Okay, excuse me. Go ahead.
And actually what happened is that some of our patient satisfaction scores, and many compensation packages in health plans, in health systems, look at your patient satisfaction scores. And one of the questions is, how well managed was your pain? And I have members all over this country who've had hospital administrators come to them and say, you need to be prescribing more pain medication because your patient satisfaction scores aren't good. And patients and physicians actually had their salaries dinged because they refused to give opioids. So now it's a sort of a predictable.
We have this epidemic.
It's a failed public policy. And my concern is that we have to find the right balance. You know, you have to find the right balance for the person who legitimately needs that medicine. We need to keep all the safeguards in place. We have, I know you have in Wisconsin, what we call a PDMP, prescription drug monitoring, but they need to be real time. They need to be up to speed. When I go around the country, the state, many of the physicians tell me that the PDMPs are as clunky as the electronic health record. The data is not valuable because it's not real time. It takes way too long to even log in and check these things. Those kinds of tools, though, when they actually work and they're up to snuff, if you will, those kinds of tools can go a long way. We're doing a lot of work across organizations, and it's one of the priorities. It's been a big part of my presidential year. I've met with the Surgeon General 3 times. I've done a lot of media interviews, and I did a call to action to our members, and our members have really stepped up. They've got 150,000 plus CME continuing medical education hours around opioids alone.
So is the old message completely gone now? And what's the new message? It's 2016.
Yeah.
What's the new message to family physicians on prescription of opioids?
Caution, there's CDC guidelines, as you may be aware. CDC guidelines specific to primary care, which is helpful. There's still a need for a little more strong evidence behind some of those guidelines, but we'll take them as they're written at the moment. The goal is to assess each patient individually. There may be a time when an opioid is appropriate, but more often than not, it's not. How do you help the patient understand that? I also need to get the health systems and still some of those administrators, we need to get that pain satisfaction off the table around pain issues. There are people who will really need it. Pain is real, but we also have to balance the need of the individual with the health of the community and the safety of the nation. And so my job as a family physician is not to do broad brush in one direction, but to use the nuances and the balance of care.
What about breaking the chain from the medicine cabinet to the streets for those that are in their teens and young 20s and 30s? Those professionals that get addicted, they started out with a prescription for some pain, and then it led to being out of control and addiction.
And I think the first thing is to ask the public to recognize that we're going to be really judicious, and not just family physicians, emergency departments, dentists, a lot of the places where we see these medications often start, your orthopedic surgeons, your neurologists, those people are not going to be giving pain medications the way that maybe society has gotten used to. And it's not because we're here to suffer, but we're here to do no harm. And how do we help you to find other ways and other modalities by which we can help to treat your pain? And so even if they start you on those medicines, if they and this happens a lot, and they say, well, there's nothing else I can do for you, look, go see your family physician, let them take over your prescribing. Happens all the time. We're saying we're going to reassess. We're not necessarily going to give you an automatic refill. We're going to stop and make sure that this is in your best interest. And there's a bunch of tools that we have out there now. We've actually, as an organization, come out with an opioid toolkit for practices to use that looks at things like depression and family history and alcohol abuse and all sorts of other things that put you at substantially increased risk for becoming one of those patients who have addiction and deploying that into the practices.
Maybe a final question. Have we hit bottom in terms of our opioid addiction epidemic nationally? Or is it going to get worse before it gets better?
Hard to know. I certainly hope we've hit bottom because this is thousands of lives, and it's particularly hitting rural America. I was at President Obama's launch of in Charleston, West Virginia, and that community has been decimated by this opioid epidemic,
yes.
Much of that state. And I think that we've turned the tide, to use the Surgeon General's comment, and there's a pledge online that he launched us in the last couple weeks, turnthetide.org, and you can go on as a physician and you can sign a pledge, and I've done it, and we're partnering with the Surgeon General on this kind of work, and they're sending out a letter to prescribers all over this country, physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, to say we need to look at this. But the public, the legislature, the payers in this country, we all have a role in this.
Okay, let's go back to the big picture as we close here. Family physicians are an integral part of America's healthcare system, and what about their future?
I think the future is incredibly bright. Okay. You know, it's a difficult time right now. We've got, as I said, we've got a lot of issues around that joy of practice. But physicians tell me they want more face-to-face time. They want more time with patients. They want to get rid of this non-value-add stuff that's taking them away from patients. But the student interest is extraordinarily high. They sense that the ship is turning, and it's turning toward primary care and specifically to family medicine, and they want to be part of that, and they want to be that change. They want to be part of that meaningful change that gets this country back on track in healthcare, and family medicine is the proven way to do that.
Thank you. Dr. Wanda Filer is president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Thank you so much for visiting Wisconsin Eye.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.